So hello everyone, and welcome to another one of our 1MSL webinars. I'm Helen Kane, CEO of 1MSL, and I'm really delighted to welcome you all to this subject, using emotional intelligence to work with physicians. This is something that I find really fascinating, and I am absolutely delighted to be joined today by my colleague Keith Willis, who is going to move us on to our second slide. Keith will be taking us through this webinar. So Keith, it's really great to have you here. We've known one another a little while, and as you know, emotional intelligence is a subject very close to my heart. And it would be great for you to introduce yourself to everyone who's joining us on the webinar. And firstly, I'm really curious to know, kind of, where did your interest in emotional intelligence come? When did that happen for you?
Thanks, Helen. So I probably would say within the last couple of years. I mean, emotional intelligence is something that comes up on a regular basis. I had gotten certified to do social styles, and I've had conversations with people around social styles, this piece around emotional intelligence keeps coming up, and it's kind of the versatility piece from a social styles perspective, and those two programs seem to go hand in hand when it comes to how do we work and collaborate and work with people more effectively. So I thought it would be a good idea to get certified in this. I had been exposed to this doing leadership development training with a couple of different companies, and emotional intelligence was something that always came up from a managerial perspective, and having a deeper understanding of how to use these skills to be more effective just managing people, I thought would be a good idea.
Fantastic. So, well, thank you so much for taking the time to run this webinar for us today. So you're very much in control. I'm going to jump in as if you invite me to. So I'm handing the stage over to you, Keith.
All right, Helen, thanks a lot. Really appreciate you having me on. I guess it's a good afternoon to many of you and good morning to others. It's about 11 o'clock a.m. on the East Coast where I am hailing from. A little bit about me. I've been in the pharmaceutical industry a little over 25 years in a variety of roles, many of them on the commercial side. I've worked closely with medical colleagues in a variety of different, from a training perspective, just working with the different teams. And then as a 1MSL consultant, I've had the opportunity to work with several different MSL teams also. So I am very, very happy to be here. So I'd like to start with, what is emotional intelligence? This is one of the definitions that I came across. The ability to understand and control your own feelings and to understand the feelings of others and to react to them in a suitable way. There's really three parts to this. The first part is the ability to understand and control your own feelings, then to understand the feelings of others, and then that last part, react to them in a suitable way, is really the behavior portion of emotional intelligence. And oftentimes in many of these programs, it's the area that we may not necessarily focus on.
Why do you think, Keith, that we forget about other people and we simply respond based on our own feelings? What is driving that for us? Sorry, I'm interjecting really early on, but I'm curious to know.
Oh, no problem at all. I think part of it is because ultimately we all think of ourselves first. When we think about our own emotions, our own feelings, we think about, how do I control that? Even when we talk about things like meditation, a lot of it has to do with our own emotions and sitting still with those emotions. So I don't think it's a surprise. And then I think it's also the evolution. So when TRACOM came up with their model, it was to focus more on behaviors. And I think behaviors are something that we struggle with on a regular basis, even when we think about performance reviews and specific observed behavior, somebody's trying to give you feedback. So that's just the area of, I think, that we all have from a development standpoint, which is why the focus rarely is on the behaviors of that people have.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you.
So according to the Future of Jobs report by the World Economic Forum, emotional intelligence will enter the top 10 most needed skills in industry by 2020. I find it interesting because if you pull down any of these reports, whether it be workforce development or other types of reports, emotional intelligence has consistently been in the top 10. And when you think about it, oftentimes on this list, you'll have things like artificial intelligence, you'll have things like machine learning and some of those hard skills, but emotional intelligence consistently is there. And I think some of that is because work environments have become more collaborative. There are more team-oriented types of goals. Teams are more matrix than they ever have been. And then 4 out of 5 managers in the healthcare say their day-to-day job is burning them out. And that was before COVID-19. I know even when I talk to a lot of people in the pharmaceutical industry, they're on back-to-back calls, trying to juggle work and family, the demands. It's just very, very difficult. And so emotional intelligence has become so important. And then here, according to the Pharmacy Times, the MSL role has become so important. And then the list of soft skills includes emotional intelligence. And you can see emotional intelligence was lifted first. And Helen, I know your background, you were at MSL. Could you speak to your thoughts around why emotional intelligence has become so important?
Yeah, well, certainly it's really interesting because when I sort of think back to my days as an MSL, and for those who are on the call who I see some names I recognise very well. So hello to you all. It's great to have you alongside us. The expectation was that we would be competent in the science, and we would be able to present data, and we would be able to respond to questions. But you know, when we do our trainings with companies today, we really focus on the importance of engaging for mutual benefit. And in order for us to engage for mutual benefit, we have to stand in the shoes of the person that we're engaging with. We have to understand their interests and needs. And in order for us to do that, we have to be able to demonstrate emotional, or use our emotional intelligence or self-awareness. And actually, as I'm looking at this slide, Keith, it almost amazes me that, you know, that we weren't talking about this 10 years ago. I'm very curious about the fact that it's a skill that is becoming more of a priority today. And for me, it probably always was a priority. And it's always been something that has fascinated me. And I guess that's perhaps one of the reasons why I established One MSL. It was, you know, this was a key driver for me. So I think for me, it is that ability, you know, if as MSLs, it is our goal to build trusted long-term partnerships. And I know that you're going to speak to this later in the presentation, Keith. Emotional intelligence plays a very important part in our ability to do that. If we engage simply with our own agenda, as you said, we think of ourselves first and foremost, then the chances are that we won't be successful in building trust, because people will say, oh, you know, this is very much about you and your agenda. You really are not listening, or you're not seeking to understand my reality. So I'm sorry, that was a very long answer to what was quite a short question. So sorry.
Oh, that's okay. I think you brought out some very, very important points. And one of the questions you asked was around why this wasn't as important maybe 10 years ago. And I don't know that it wasn't as important. I think the medical affairs didn't play the role that it plays now. Mm-hmm. Medical affairs has grown over 300% in the last decade. And I found that fascinating. When you look at the number of jobs and the number of roles and the roles that did not exist 10 years ago. And then I think the other thing is that providers need more clinical real world outcomes. And I think part of that is because there's more data. available than there ever was. And so it becomes very, very difficult for providers to determine what data is relevant and what isn't. And so somebody from, whether it be a MSL or somebody in the medical affairs team, ability to sort through and understand a provider's challenges is going to be able to better able to explain the outcomes of some of these studies and some of the real world data that's out there. And then according to McKinsey, medical affairs has become the third strategic pillar for the pharmaceutical industry. So where I am in my backyard, there's a biotech, startup center, and there are numerous number of companies, and the number of people from the medical side of the business that are starting these companies has been tremendous. And Helen, maybe you could speak to the McKinsey report some, because I know you're very familiar with this.
Yeah. I mean, I cite McKinsey 2025 quite a lot, because, you know, it is this idea about, you know, as you say, well, in some organizations, medical may currently be the third strategic pillar, but in other organizations, medical has a way to go. But really at the center of everything, and we see this word on your slide here, you know, when we stand in the shoes of our providers or, you know, people that are having to make some really tough decisions, it's all about the patient. And I think that this is where the, you know, when we ask ourselves why we do what we do, when we're running workshops for teams on brand and identity, you know, this is something that we will explore with them, is, you know, how do you believe that you bring value and impact to your organization? And it's so, it's often fascinating, because people will very often talk about the scientific expertise. They will talk about the trial opportunities. They will talk about, you know, the opportunity to perhaps be involved in IITs and so on. And sometimes we have to push them quite hard as if, who do you do it for? You know, and it's this whole piece about the patient, because ultimately that's where the emotion comes in. And so for me, it's kind of thinking, if everything that we do is an ultimate support of the patient, then inevitably we have to think about our EQ, because the people that are having to make the decisions for their patients, they most certainly are having to use their EQ in order to engage and discuss.
So we have set the stage for you in regards to what is emotional intelligence, why it's important, and why you need it from a medical affairs and MSL perspective. And what I would like you to do is consider someone or a group of people that you work with that you would like to strengthen your collaboration with. And how would improved emotional intelligence impact this relationship? And I just want you to kind of hold that thought for a little bit. We're going to come back to that towards the end of the presentation, where you can think about some of the things we're going to share with you that you'll be able to utilize. Before we do that, I want to talk about some myths in regards to emotional intelligence. And there are three myths out there. One of them is that emotional intelligence is just means being empathetic and understanding others' emotions. And I wish it were that simple, but I do know that some people struggle with empathy. The reality of it is that emotional intelligence starts with self-awareness. Individuals with strong EQ will understand how to identify and regulate their own emotions. Myth number two, emotional intelligence is the most important indicator of professional success. And I've seen several studies or several facilitators talk about that emotional intelligence is a key indicator of success. And while I believe that emotional intelligence is valuable in all fields, especially with medical affairs and medicine, I don't know that it's the most important factor in long-term success. Ultimately, functional technical knowledge is always important. And I know that we've all seen people that you would probably surmise don't have strong emotional intelligence, and they've done extremely well in their careers. I often like to think of Steve Jobs as an example of this. Early in his career, he lost his company because of his emotional intelligence. So just note that functional technical skills are very important, but while they're important, emotional intelligence oftentimes can make the difference.
Let me ask you a question, Keith. How do you know? How would you say to me, person X does not have any emotional intelligence? What would you be seeing or hearing that would lead you to that conclusion?
So I'll caveat that with, however, if you think in terms of managers that you have worked with or people that you have worked with, and there are some people that people just don't like. Somebody that maybe they yell, they go overboard about things that may seem trivial. People tiptoe around them. Maybe you're in a meeting. There's somebody that may be a little belligerent. Maybe they don't treat people nicely. So those are all signs that there are areas where people have gaps with emotional intelligence. And sometimes these gaps are really visible and the impact that they have on people are pretty negative. And I would say that when, especially in roles where you're working with people on a regular basis and collaboration and teamwork have become so important, anything that disrupts that gets in the way of progress and gets in the way of the types of outcomes that people are looking for. So they may have a lot of courage, maybe to speak up, maybe say things that need to be said, but have not developed the skill to say it in a way.
Okay, thank you.
And then the last myth is emotional intelligence is innate. You either have it or you don't. Well, fortunately, that's not true. Now, there are some people that have an aptitude that seem to be really good with emotional intelligence, have really strong social skills, but it is something that you can learn. And the earlier you begin to learn to read nonverbal cues and understand conscious and unconscious bias, the more quickly you'll accelerate your emotional intelligence. So those are just some myths that are out there.
Can I ask though, Keith? Sorry, I'm going to keep doing this, I'm afraid. This is so our world has changed. Our world of engaging with our physician has changed. So if we in the days pre-COVID-19, when we were engaging with our physician in their office, we were able. These nonverbal cues were pretty obvious because we were in the same space as them, and it was much easier to build rapport and to really identify where they were. And we're now working, or we're now operating in a time where MSLs in particular, for the foreseeable future, I imagine, will be engaging in a virtual context with their physicians, many of whom may choose or may not be able to have their cameras on. So surely, does that not create some challenges for us with respect to emotional intelligence in that space? What do you feel about that?
It does present some challenges, and for a myriad of reasons. Number one, when we were seeing our customers or physicians live, oftentimes we did not necessarily tap into all of the cues that they were giving us. But because we had more environmental cues, we could put together enough of a story to figure out what was happening. When you're on camera, you can't see nearly as much. And we oftentimes find that people are not very good at identifying or even seeing some of the physical cues or the facial cues that they may not necessarily pick up on. Think in terms of we have half as many cues to tap into, and we also are somewhat distracted. You have the technology you have to play with. If your company has an iPad or a tool or resource where you're utilizing and showing the clinical studies, you may be paying attention to that. So you miss some of the other cues that your physician may be giving you. So it is challenging from a virtual perspective. And some of it really does take training and a little more focus. And I think like everything, as we spend more time in this virtual environment, I think we'll get a lot more effective at it. And my experience has been that when you blend virtual and live interactions together, it actually strengthens relationships. So physicians that people have met virtually, when they meet them live, they'll find that they may have better relationships. So just a little bit more time and focus here will clearly make us a lot better in this area.
Okay, great. Thanks, Keith.
So I'm going to get a little into the science. And so we, in our brain, we have two operating systems. In Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow, he talks about it as System One and System Two. System One is kind of that fast, look for quick, easy solution, often is irrational, often is wrong. And the other one is our logical, more slow and cautious self. Our brain operates from the lowest common denominator. So, in other words, we like to use the least amount of energy as possible. And what science generally shows us is that our brain has a negativity bias. There have been numerous studies on this. This one study was done out of the University of Chicago, where they looked at where they showed people positive, negative, and neutral stimuli. And when they looked back at the electrical pulses from the brain, the focus was more on the negative part. And so our brains have been wired for that. And the rationale behind that, if you think in terms of in the caveman times, if there was a saber-toothed tiger chasing you, you had to have immediate reaction. The fight or flight mechanism took place. You didn't have time to be thinking, hey, is this lion real happy to see me? If you were the caveman on the far left, you probably wouldn't be around to survive. And so over the years, our bodies have basically our brains have been built this way. So if you think in terms of our brain, our amygdala, this is where the fight or flight response resides. And then you think in terms of the prefrontal cortex. The prefrontal cortex is our thinking brain, and our thinking brain and our amygdala are connected and tied together. So as we build more skill, our prefrontal cortex can overcome our amygdala and our common human nature, which is oftentimes to react on a regular basis. So from a brain perspective, this is how we're built. And as a consequence of that, we'll have amygdala triggers, or some people like to call them hijacks. And when we have a hijack, the lion comes out at the wrong time. So things like lack of respect, unfair treatment, underappreciated, not heard, unrealistic deadlines, those are all things that are triggers in the workplace, which is significantly different than being chased by a lion or being shot at. So what does this mean when working with others? Well, you think in terms of people oftentimes will feel threatened. They'll focus on what's going wrong versus right. They'll feel overwhelmed. And ultimately, what that does is it damages relationships. And so these are all the things that we bring to the table when we're meeting and having conversations with our physicians. So how might we misinterpret our physicians based on this and some of our amygdala triggers? And those are things that impact our relationship or don't allow us to be as close or to be able to provide the type of information that we need to provide. We have these stories that we tell ourselves that may or may not be true.
So this is this word perception, isn't it, really, that
Exactly.
we talk a lot about, and a lot of that is kind of based on so many sort of different factors, isn't it? How we perceive people. That's a really interesting comment that's just come in. I find them hard to reach. So they're a bit distant. Of course, they're dealing with multiple challenges, aren't they? Physicians in this current climate, that is something that we have to consider as well.
And these are all things that are just so difficult because we're dealing with our own stuff. And then how do you build that connection to have that conversation? And then given the pressures from a work perspective where we're expected to deliver this clinical information, or we have these legal regulatory sitting on one shoulder, and maybe our manager's sitting on the other shoulder saying, you need to deliver this information. And you're thinking, I only have 10 minutes to do this. And so all of that adds into this disconnect that oftentimes that we'll have with our physicians.
And also, just if before you just go on to your next slide, and I just want to touch on that last comment that came in, which was, finding them hard to reach. So, what I would say to you is, try to stand in their shoes, try to consider what is going on for them in their world, because what we have to really do is to reach them, is for them to see the value in engaging with you. So if you are reaching out to engage based on an agenda that is entirely your agenda, then if that is not aligned to what they are in need of at this time, then they will find reasons to not engage with you. So consider how you can create a communication pathway to them, which demonstrates that you would like to understand how you might engage for mutual benefit, so that it can be a value, so that they see what's in it for them, as opposed to you thinking about what's in it for you. I hope that makes sense. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I think this piece around mutual benefit is so important. And, you know, I think that when physicians see the mutual benefit, they begin to see us as a trusted advisor. And so sometimes being a trusted advisor isn't necessarily always about the business, but your customer knowing that you actually care. And once they understand that, they're willing to give you more time, give you benefit of the doubt. And so those all go into, you know, building these relationships. And I think that does a nice job of really taking us into the emotional intelligence model. There are several models that are out there. This one is a model that's done by TRACOM, and its focus is a lot more of its focus is on the behaviors. Daniel Goleman, who I like to say is the godfather of emotional intelligence, has a model, and there are several other models that you'll find. And some common themes that you'll find will be around self-awareness, self-regulation, internal motivation, empathy, as well as social skills. And so we're going to talk about some of these items at a high level, give you a few skills and some things to think about as you interact with not only your physicians, but even some of your coworkers, whether they be internal or external. So self-awareness, or tune into yourself. I think that Abe Lincoln is a perfect model of this. Abe Lincoln was probably one of the most hated people in 1863. So imagine you're the president of the United States. The Union is engaged in a war where everybody thinks that the Union is not trying to succeed from the United States. So they also hate Lincoln. And Lincoln had a lot of tragedy in his life. Not only did his son die, he suffered with bouts of depression. And so he was, in a lot of ways, a very lonely man and by himself. And in 1863, around the 4th of July, the Battle of Gettysburg occurred. And he felt very strongly that General Meade, who was the Union general, had squandered his opportunity to possibly end the war and chase the Confederacy. And he wrote a letter to General George Meade about his disappointment and how he felt. Now, I'm sure all of you, or some of you, have gotten an email, a note that has been, when you looked at it, you had some strong emotions. And so imagine that during this war, where many people died on both sides, imagine getting this letter from your boss. Well, Abraham Lincoln didn't send that letter. He put that letter in his drawer, and it was discovered after his death. And so his self-awareness, he let his emotions flow, but his self-awareness let him not necessarily send that letter. And I think also he was able to tap into a lot of his failures. He had run for office numerous times as a political candidate, had failed. And so he was somebody that learned a lot. He looked at those failures and asked himself, what can I learn from this? And he took those lessons to heart. He was somebody that taught himself how to be a great communicator. I didn't know that he studied Shakespeare, but when you look at parts of the Gettysburg Address and other addresses that he had written in some of his writings, you can see his communication skills come through, but this is something that he worked through. And so this self-awareness to channel some of the lessons that he had learned into knowledge helped him be quite successful. So I like to say Lincoln is one that really did a good job of tuning into himself. And it's something that we can do is tap into and understand what our emotions are. And then I think that takes us into this piece around self-regulation. So our ability to be able to regulate these emotions and not act becomes really important. And I want to bring everybody's attention to the marshmallow experiment. So I don't know how many of you are familiar with this experiment, but this was an experiment that was done at Stanford University in 1972. And children, they were generally about 4.5 years of age. So any of you that have children or nieces or nephews that are that age, you know how impulsive children can be. And they were offered a choice of one small but immediate reward, which was a marshmallow. Or if they waited, and usually the wait time was about 10 or 15 minutes, if they were able to wait that amount of time and not eat the one marshmallow, they would get a second marshmallow. So they would get two treats. And so I want to play this for you real quickly to get some insight into some of the things that kids did.
Right, but just before you go on, Keith, I'm really curious to hear what you're going to say about that, but the whole tune into yourself piece and about, you know, growing as individuals, when we consider our engagement with our physicians, if we are able to ask ourselves at the end, so do a bit of a self-coaching conversation, so what went well, what didn't go so well, what might do differently the next time, that's such a simple and you know it doesn't take long, but if we can get into the habit of doing it, then it will allow us to hopefully learn and to think about what we could maybe do to really be even better the next time.
So yeah, Helen, I did want to get into this whole thing around the self-regulation and be your own boss. And I think you point out a really important point about having the discipline or you know, monitor yourself and look at your results, or this whole this self-coaching piece, whether it be with your customer or projects and things that you do. The thing that was interesting around this Stanford study is they followed these children over the course of several years, and what they found that those children that were able to wait and not eat those marshmallows, they had better life outcomes. And that was as of measured by SAT scores, educational attainment, weight, and other factors versus children that were not able to wait. And so, you know, obviously if there are interventions and you teach even young children additional skills, they learn these skills. But sometimes the differentiation, you think in terms of the industry where everybody has strong functional technical skills, sometimes it's this ability to be able to monitor what you say, what you do, or even making the choice of, I'm not going to be on social media, I'm not going to spend time doing a ton of email, I'm going to focus on this project or take an extra hour or two, or engage in some self-coaching and have some level of self-awareness to say, maybe that didn't go as well as I thought it would go, and consistently develop those habits will help people really, I think, scale their career, because sometimes it's that differentiation, having the ability to be able to self-monitor behavior and think about some of the things that you're doing.
And then also, and if I can just add into that, so thinking back, you know, when we're thinking about our engagement with our physicians, if we have created an objective that contains an action and an outcome for our meeting, we are then, and we may or may not share that objective with our physician, but we could do it in the context of saying, this is, you know, I'm here and this is really what I'd like to know. I'd like to understand your thoughts on the data that we presented or whatever it is. By stating our objective, we're then able to look back at the end of our meeting to understand from the physician if that engagement has been of value. So did it meet their needs? So again, that is another way that we can use our emotional intelligence in terms of engaging. Or maybe am I making an assumption too far, Keith? Because you're the
No.
expert, not me.
No, I think you're definitely right on point. You know, I think all of these things really come together, and that's why it's a constellation of skills. It's not just one thing. It's all of these skills come together. And you know, if you think about it, yeah, you know, people may be on the webinar thinking it's a call, it's a physician call, but it's the difference, and sometimes it's the 1% difference oftentimes that makes all of the difference in the world. So you make some excellent points, Helen. And this other piece, and I know that you had referred to this a little earlier, tune into others, or this kind of this empathy piece, sitting in our customer shoes. And, you know, the question I have here, do you recognize the needs of your physicians? And in the backdrop is Naomi Osaka and Coco Gauff. This is a year ago at the U.S. Open, where Naomi had beaten Coco Gauff, and Coco was very, very upset. And so Naomi stood in her shoes and thought about, you know, this young lady is 16 years old, and she's on center court. She's in front of all of these people. She hasn't necessarily played her best tennis, but she's a rising star. And she encouraged her to stay for the interviews, and they were interviewed together. And it was a very, very moving scene where you could see how Naomi was really using her empathy, and Coco really looks up to Naomi. And I think about maybe 2 years ago when Serena Williams lost the U.S. Open and was very upset, because she had gotten some bad calls. And so the crowd started booing, and Serena, you know, stepped in and basically told the crowd, well, it wasn't Naomi's fault. She played a great game, and that they should be celebrating her. And so she exhibited some empathy there. Now, the circumstances were a little different, because Serena showed some of her bad emotional intelligence, a fiery competitor. But she also showed a lot of her strong emotional intelligence. And do we sit in their shoes, and do we think about what their thoughts and what their feelings are? You know, do we really need 30 minutes when we can take 20 minutes? Do we take the extra time to do some extra planning, because we recognize physicians don't necessarily have a lot of time, or the time that they need may be quality time, or maybe they just need to talk and blow off some steam because of some of the stressors of their job. So this piece around recognizing the needs of your physician and really standing in their shoes is so important. And one of the ways we can do this, and we talked a little bit earlier about this this environment that we're in, where we don't, you know, where you don't have a lot of cues. And I wanted to throw some of these pictures up here and see if you could identify. Now, notice the surprise and the fear look fairly similar, and so it's hard to mistake. And there are generally six basic emotions: happy, sad, fearful, angry, surprised, disgusted. Paul Ekman is I believe he's a psychologist. I know he had done a lot of studies on these facial movements, and they had come up with a variety of, and think in terms of, out of these six, there you can identify probably 100 different emotions just from these six basic ones. Contempt is another one that comes up oftentimes. And we have gotten in the habit where we don't recognize these anymore. We don't pay attention to them anymore. And oftentimes we'll miss these cues when we're working with our customers and with our physicians. One of the things that's interesting, children of alcoholics have gotten very good at identifying these emotional cues. And part of it is that they needed to know how their parent was going to react, or what type of mood their parent was in when they arrived at home. So it was a defensive mechanism for children. So you'll find that people that have been in an alcoholic family get real good at identifying some of these emotions. And so these are just one of the ways we can improve some skill sets in identifying this, especially when we're in a virtual environment. A really quick, funny story. I had a sales representative that when I interviewed them, they told me they could not read my emotions at all. And later on, when they started working for me, we'd be sitting in the car and they would look at me and they would say, "You didn't like that conversation with that physician, did you?" And I guess it was written all over my face. And it was just so funny how over the course of probably 3 or 4 months, they went from not being able to read my facial cues to being able to see it was written all over my face. And the benefit of that was they were able to get coaching from me about what went well and what didn't, because it was clear that they were open to that feedback, because they would say, what, tell me. And it was so funny, but it was amazing how that little skill helped differentiate them from other people that worked for me. So Oprah, I could have put her in any one of these pictures from a skill perspective. She has a high level of emotional intelligence. I would say that, you know, her show was the highest rated during its time spot from 1986 to 2011. That's 25 years. She was the ultimate interviewer. She had the ability to build rapport, develop relationships, and she's really good at asking effective questions. So questions are our friends, especially if they're the questions that are placed at the right place in the right time, and not questions that somebody's expecting you to ask, but really questions that dig deep and get into and help you get insight. And Oprah is known for being a really good listener, being able to listen to others and relate to others. Just can be as simple as asking a really good effective question and getting people to open up, or just getting people to be very comfortable with us. So our relationships do make a difference when we interact with our physicians. And that brings us to this trust quotient. So we talked a lot about emotional intelligence over the course of the hour, and this, our ability to develop trust is so important. This trust quotient is credibility plus reliability and empathy to the degree of our self-interest. Now, we all have to have some level of self-interest because it relates to our focus. But if we're always focused on ourselves, then that trust quotient is going to go down. And then, you know, credibility, I think, gets back to your functional technical skills, your credentials, your honesty. And then your reliability, your actions, and how you keep your promises. And then empathy, as we talked about earlier, through your personal connection. So all of these pieces around this trust quotient are important when it comes to working with our customers. And I think from an emotional intelligence standpoint, emotional intelligence plays into this whole equation. Helen, any comments around this trust quotient?
Oh, well, you know that this is a bedrock for me for the MSL. I find this really, really powerful. And I you know, I really love teaching it. And actually, you know, because we bring this into the trust continuum as well. It's about thinking where you are in your journey of trust with your physician. So coming back to some of the comments earlier, you know, thinking about that physician that you're struggling to see at this particular time, you know, where are you in terms of a level of trust, and how can you demonstrate trust towards them so that they, you know, how can you minimize the level of self-interest so that they might want to engage with you? So consider the trust quotient in the context of your colleagues, both internally, but in particular think about it in terms of your external relationships. It's a very powerful tool for me, so thank you for using it, Keith.
Well, thank you for sharing it. So in the beginning, we talked about someone or a group of people that you would like to strengthen your collaboration with. So hopefully you have thought of someone, and based off of some of the content that we have shared here over the last hour, my question for you would be, what would be one thing that you could do going forward that would strengthen your relationship with this person or that group of persons?
We know, Keith, from our virtual engagement workshops that 30 seconds is a very long time in a webinar. Sometimes people think, oh my goodness, the signal's dropped off. And there's always someone that feels the need to fill the silence. And in this case, it's me. I'm really mindful of, of time. And I think is that your final slide?
I have one. I have one more. Just one more slide. So these are just some resources. Vanessa Van Edwards has a book, Captivate. Joe Navarro is a body language expert. He's a former FBI profiler. Amy Cutter is a researcher. Paul Ekman, you know, another researcher. Neurolinguistic programming is, you know, a program that really delves into some different methodologies and things that you can do to build rapport and communicate more effectively with people. And Daniel Goleman, as I said earlier, is really the godfather of emotional intelligence. So those are some good resources for people to Google search on.